to Earth Matters here on Gila Members Community Radio, KURU, at 89.1 FM. This is Donna Stevens, Executive Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and we're a local watershed protection nonprofit, and I'm your host for today's program. Today we're going to talk about energy, both clean and dirty, Public Service Company of New Mexico, known as PNM, and the Public Regulation Commission's hearings on PNM's proposed 20-year energy plan. Joining me here in the studio is local climate activist Deborah James. Welcome, Deb.
Hi, Donna. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, I had you on the show back in April, and we'll talk about that a little bit later.
Okay.
But I wanted to start talking about energy here in New Mexico. So I've read that PNM's current energy portfolio consists of 56% coal, 20% nuclear, 15% gas, 8% wind, or 6% wind, excuse me, and about 3% solar. So if they're going to use gas, that's a little bit cleaner than coal, isn't it? So what's your problem, basically, with gas?
What's my problem?
Right.
Let me back up a little bit here. Natural gas has been touted as clean energy, but it's still a fossil fuel and one of the worst methane producers out there during extraction. The International Panel on Climate Change came out last March and conclusively stated that human-caused carbon emissions and the release of methane are the sources of rapid climate change. Congress obviously doesn't like that reality and has voted against adding that statement into the Keystone XL bill, you probably noticed, that's now on the table. And so now we're all waiting for them to vote on the reality of gravity.
It's just a theory after all, right?
That's right. So this is important background information to your question. The Tyndall Center for Climate Change Research tells us in its recent report that wealthy nations need to start cutting their greenhouse gases by 8 to 10% per year beginning now if we want a 50-50 chance of keeping below a rise in temperature of 2 degrees Celsius. The International Energy Agency tells us that investment levels in clean energy need to quadruple by 2030. This means setting goals of 100% renewable energy by 2050. A goal that PNM can't possibly begin to achieve on behalf of New Mexico and New Mexicans if we reinvest in coal, increase our use of natural gas, and nuclear power. So what if we don't adhere to these goals of 100% by 2050? The consequences are not just a warming planet to which we need to adapt. The ripples from continuing this lunacy of extracting and burning fossil fuels, which raises global temperatures, includes serious health hazards for humans, mass extinctions of other species, depletion of clean water sources, increased forest fires, as we know here in Southwest, weather superstorms, rising sea levels, all of which create millions of climate refugees every year. And our military recognizes that this displacement of people is the biggest security risk we face on the planet. Specifically, the problems with natural gas include the reality that there's only difficult to obtain natural gas reserved in the earth, and that requires hydraulic fracturing or fracking extracted from shale beds. And we have some of those shale beds. The Mancos shale bed, which has tongues throughout New Mexico, from which we're fracking natural gas. Hydraulic fracturing is a bad deal, Donna. For one, it releases dangerous levels of methane. Methane is a potent greenhouse gas. According to the EPA, pound for pound, over 20 times more potent than carbon dioxide. And if you want to check those details, you can go to the epa.gov website and look under climate change, greenhouse gas emissions. But now, let's get to some health issues. It requires injecting large amounts of a chemical cocktail that nobody really knows the composition of because nobody's releasing those details into the ground, along with an initial million gallons of precious water to begin pumping it out of the ground. Most of those noxious chemicals, and we know that they're noxious, leach into the groundwater.
It seems to me we mostly know they're noxious because they won't tell us what they are.
Yes.
So like if it was mother's milk, they'd be glad to admit that, right?
Right, exactly. And as some of you know, I marched across the country with the Great March for Climate Action from March of last year till November of this year. And on our march across the nation, we stayed with families in the Marcellus Shale region in Ohio and Pennsylvania. And so, and those families, they've lost not just livestock, but family members due to fracking-related illness. Luckily, New York's Mayor Cuomo has been the first to acknowledge the dangers thanks to protests by fracked families.
Against the governor, by the
right.
way. Sorry.
Ah, thank you. Let's see, against the lethal practice of fracking. But it is fracked gas that PNM proposes to use in increasing quantity to produce New Mexico's electricity.
Wow, so we have fracking going on right here in the state already.
Yep, we do.
Well, so what about nuclear energy? I mean, is that, you know, a lot of even kind of green people say nuclear energy is a lot cleaner than coal. So what's the deal with nuclear?
Well, nuclear energy is touted as nice, clean energy. And perhaps there's a one-third truth there. As the electricity is produced, the plant emits only steam with low levels of contamination. Underscore contamination. Mm-hmm. However, the input and the output are the dangerous parts. To create nuclear energy, you have to have uranium, a substance which must be extracted from the earth. If we purchase more nuclear power from the Palo Verde power plant in Arizona, this will necessitate increased uranium supplies, and that has justified the movement to reopen northern New Mexico uranium mines. The proposed reopening of uranium mines on Navajo lands is a really scary proposition. There is an entire generation of Navajos who are no longer with us because of jobs in uranium mines in the 50s and 60s and the contamination of their groundwater from that extraction. There are no grandfathers and very few grandmothers alive to share their traditions with their children and grandchildren. If you haven't watched it, you need to watch the film Yellow Fever. It was recently produced on and by the members of the Navajo Nation.
Okay.
The next problem is output, which has two forks. It takes large amounts of precious water to create nuclear energy, and the Palo Verde power plant touts the fact that it uses reclaimed water from the Phoenix area going in.
Mm-hmm.
However, irradiated water comes out and goes back into the water table and affects the health and well-being of agriculture and humans and livestock and wildlife that are also dependent on that same water. We, on the march, camped on the lands of some of these farmers in northern Arizona who told us horror stories about their water. The second problem is that we still have not solved the problem of what to do with nuclear waste. In the 80s, the WIP site was set up to receive defense-generated nuclear waste in the salt caves near Carlsbad. Well, they're leaking, folks.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, all of our commercially generated nuclear waste is being stored in temporary holding tanks spread all over, many of them on the grounds of nuke plants. And some of these tanks are leaking or have leaked, contaminating our soil and our water. Nuclear waste remains a danger for a minimum of 100,000 years. And some estimates say as long as a million years. Now, to put this time frame into context, 100,000 years is roughly 4,000 human generations.
Wow.
How do we possibly ensure that we can isolate this dangerous material for that time frame?
I think a lot of politicians who make these decisions just think, well, I won't be around to see the consequences of that action. I mean, my term's up in 4 years, so they're out of here. And I think they just think on these very short time scales. They don't care about a million years out.
It's mysterious, isn't it? I mean,
yes,
you and I think
mysterious.
About our own grandchildren.
Yes.
So then there's always the risk of catastrophic accidents like Fukushima.
Yeah, and there was an accident at WIP, like you're saying, the leaking vats. We had a program right here on Earth Matters a couple of months back about the leaks at the WIP plant near Carlsbad. So it isn't just halfway around the world. It's right here in our state.
Yeah. Politicians tend to put their blinders on about things like that because
yes,
there's money
do.
To be made.
Yep. So, speaking of money, I mean, some people have invested money in buying their own photovoltaic units and putting these on their roofs, and they're not very happy because the rate of selling the electricity back to the grid, back to PNM, it's PNM is proposing to decrease that amount. So, what are the implications there?
Implications. Well, who would want to invest in PV panels on their rooftops if the rate of return is negligible? To me, it appears to be strong-arming citizens from participating in a new energy economy.
So people who are they're paying whatever the rate is, and I don't know what it is, so the people who are producing electricity through solar panels on their own roofs, they're not getting the amount that PNM is charging customers, right? They're
That's
not getting that much money.
And I'm not really up to speed on this information since I'm just a peasant without a PV panel. So I consulted Gail Simmons from Wentz Electric. She and her husband, Craig Wentz, do the lion's share of PV installations in Grant County and beyond. And Gail is, among other things, on the cutting edge of information regarding renewable energy. Gail is the go-to gal if you're an owner of PV panels who is concerned about the return rate decrease. She recommends an article called Rethinking Fixed Charges and Standby Fees. And I think you can Google just that much, Rethinking Fixed Charges and Standby Fees. The rest of it says regulatory and rate design pathways to deeper solar cost reductions.
So this cost reduction in how much PNM would pay back to people who have solar panels, is this part of their 20-year plan?
Apparently not. We were told when we were at the hearing that, if you may remember this since we went together, the hearing officer said the rate decrease for PV owners is not part of this discussion.
Oh,
it will be a separate discussion.
Oh, okay. I see. So one of the things I've heard you talk about, Deb, in the past is the social cost of carbon. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, I touched on this subject when I spoke about fracking and uranium mining and about climate refugees, but let me go a little deeper, Donna. You know, there are several nations in the dominant culture who actually have an official benefit cost analysis that includes the social cost of carbon pollution. I don't know. I guess my female brain just doesn't get how social dangers can only be understood if they can figure into a cost analysis.
Right.
But I'll refer you to the April 2014 report anyway. Go to the site costofcarbon.org, and you can read every line if you're interested.
Okay.
But I'm an educator of the social sciences. Looking at the social implications of human behavior throughout history and the current era is just how I view the world. And what I have seen over the course of the 63 years of my life alone has been both fascinating and disconcerting. The choices that big industry has made since the Industrial Revolution began and the growth-based economic system that those choices have supported have caused horrific harm, even if they hadn't caused rapid climate change. You know, while I was on the Great March, I spoke with an older woman named Josephine in Michigan City, Indiana, where she's lived throughout her life. First, their lives were dependent on the steel industry there in, on the south shores of Lake Michigan. And more recently, it has been on BP, or British Petroleum, who is happily processing tar sands crude brought in by tankers and train cars from Canada while they're waiting for the Keystone Pipeline to go through.
Yeah.
So two-story high piles of pet coke, which is a toxic byproduct of tar sands, are visible from her front door. And she told me this. She says, "You folks are right. This is a climate crisis. But this isn't anything new. For three generations or more, my family has had to live with soot-covered laundry on our lines and polluted fishing and swimming holes and grandpas who die too young from diseases caused by their work that the company denies responsibility for. And for the last decade, we working poor now battle uninsulated homes that are given to us by or rented to us by the company to try to stay warm in the winter and cool without air conditioning that we never used to need in the summer." The thing now is that some rich folks in Miami are concerned about their second or third homes on the beach getting flooded every high tide. And now it's a crisis.
Yeah, of course.
"Well, good," she says. "I'm glad they're waking up."
Yeah. Let's talk about that some more. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. If you're just joining us, I'm Donna Stevens, the Executive Director of the Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and I'm your host for today's program. With me today in the studio in beautiful downtown Silver City is climate activist Deborah James. And we were just talking before the break about her theory and other people's theory of the social cost of carbon pollution. So it isn't just environment that it's affecting, but I mean, obviously the environment affects us because we live in it. And we were just talking about some people who have to deal, who've been dealing for decades with a lot of pollution due to the oil and gas industry. So can you talk about that some more, Deb? You were just mentioning the woman who you talked to on your climate march in Indiana.
Right. And the fact that now problems are exacerbated because they have to deal with extremely cold winters and extremely hot summers.
Mm. Yeah.
So this is all kind of snuck up on us. As one of my fellow climate marchers, Gavin U. Pritchard, who is from Missouri, he stated recently, up until now, climate change has prompted only a sidelong response and not a full frontal redress, because climate change has masqueraded as a nebulous problem of slowly worsening conditions for life. I thought that was a pretty poignant statement.
It is good. I mean, so some of the people who have been dealing with it for a long time, these are kind of the disenfranchised people who we never hear from.
Right.
Because they don't have clout. They don't have any political clout. Nobody pays any attention to what they have to say. But they've already been dealing with it.
That's right. They are the voiceless.
Yep.
So what I've learned as a devoted student of history is that fear, desperation, and lack of information inevitably lead to social chaos. The social cost of carbon comes to us in the form of fearful people, citizens, even in our own country, who feel powerless against the regulations that favor the fossil fuel industry and ignore local inhabitants. It comes in the form of angry indigenous people who no longer have access to adequate water supplies because precious water is being privatized and sent to agribusiness and sold to L.A. and Phoenix. It comes in the form of illness and untimely death that result from the last desperate attempt of fossil fuel industries to extract the last and dirtiest products in the ground for the sake of profit. It comes in the form of homelessness and the refugee status given to those humans from island and coastal nations who can no longer live in their ancestral land because of superstorms and sea level rise. It comes from the disenfranchisement that results from the realization that one lives in a sacrifice zone and that they're just disposable people. It comes in the form of panic on the part of business owners and employers about their own livelihoods, so they don't hire enough employees for enough hours at a living wage. It comes in the form of panic and distress of the working poor who can't find decent jobs right here in Silver City. Their choices are the fast food industry or big box stores, which offer them no job skills and no self-respect. So they go home and beat their girlfriends, or they just give up on the job scene and they sell drugs. The social term for this is despondency. All of this sits under the umbrella of the climate crisis and can lead to chaos.
Oh, so it's really all connected. I mean, the environment is affecting how people behave.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to get back to what PNM is proposing in their 20-year plan. And I've read that they're planning to shut down two units at their San Juan Generating Station, which is in the north corner of New Mexico, northwest corner. And it's a coal-fired plant. And they plan to install pretty pricey pollution controls on the remaining two units. So, I mean, at first glance, these seem like really good developments, right? Shutting down a couple of units, fixing the other two. So what's the rest of the picture here?
Well, two things are at play here, Donna. The extraction of coal and the burning of coal. We've known for a long time that burning coal makes the dirtiest fossil fuel emissions out there, only slightly mitigated by the scrubbers they propose to put on the units. And holes have been shot clear through the whole clean coal theory.
Hmm.
But what hasn't been revealed until recently is that when we extract coal or any fossil fuel from the ground, we release methane, which I mentioned before is 20 times more dangerous than carbon emissions. About 29% of USA methane released into the atmosphere comes from natural gas extraction and petroleum system extraction. An additional 10% comes from coal mining. Methane releases any time we extract formerly living or fossilized material from the ground. For example, as the ice sheets melt, all of the organisms once living that were frozen in the ice release methane in large quantities. We're learning that methane contributes to the greenhouse effect at a far faster rate than even carbon emissions. So to burn coal, we have to keep extracting it. We have coal mines right here in New Mexico that need to close. And in spite of what the Navajo Nation President Shelley has said, we need to replace those mining jobs with clean, renewable jobs.
Yeah, I mean, when we were at that hearing at the first week of January, I believe he was the first speaker in the public comment period, and he went on at length about how important these jobs are to the Navajo Nation. And then he was followed up by many people from the Navajo Nation who had a quite an opposing viewpoint. And it seemed really short-sighted to me that all he cared about was the jobs and not what those jobs actually were and how they were affecting the people who had the jobs or the people who lived in the area. So
it sounded to me like most of the members of their nation would agree with you.
Yeah, it sure seemed like it. There was some pretty compelling and actually moving testimony from those people. So, I mean, it seems to me that the tribes could be putting their members to work building solar panels and other parts that are needed in a green economy. Isn't that right? I mean, if you close the coal plants, we're not talking about all these people being out of work altogether. They could be doing something else that would be good.
That's right. That's right. We'll talk more about that when we talk about jobs. But as you said, there is already entrepreneurship going on within the Navajo Nation and other tribal groups. They're creating solar panels. They're building parts for other renewable industries out there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, private individuals are really trying to make this transition.
Yeah. So PNM has just come up with this 20-year plan. That's what we're talking about here today. And can you kind of summarize for our listeners what PNM's plan actually is?
Okay. I am looking at an article in the New Mexican that came out January 4th that lays this out really nicely. And it says, you mentioned what our current status is. They plan to go from 62% coal to 46% coal. They plan to go from 22% nuclear to 33% nuclear, from 9% natural gas to 10% natural gas, from 1.2% solar to 3% after the plan, and from 5.5% wind to 7.5%. Wind.
Those don't seem like very big increases for renewable energy.
Well, in
I guess
cost,
because they aren't, right?
They aren't. The cost, if you want to know about these, is in order to revive the San Juan Unit 4, it will cost $26 million. PNM currently owns a portion of three nuclear reactors at the Palo Verde Nuclear Station in northern Arizona. Electricity from two of the reactors is already part of their energy portfolio for New Mexico bill payers. PNM is seeking to add Palo Verde number 3 at 134 megawatts, costing $221 million. At the hearing, it was announced that they plan to convert the existing coal unit to eventually to a natural gas unit, which sometime during this 20-year period. I don't know how they can say that they would only go from 9 to 10% gas, but maybe they're figuring where they're going to begin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what do you see as the problems with PNM's proposed plan?
Well, besides the environmental impact, which includes the social impact and public health, of using coal, natural gas, and nuclear power. I'm going to quote Tom Manning, who happens to be, wave to Tom, he's across the street
right
now, asking for signatures on a petition to block this plan. He says it locks New Mexicans into nuclear, coal, and gas for the next 20 years, precluding any significant increase in renewable energy. It's not the most cost-effective, it's not the best environmental outcome, and it's not the best jobs outcome. PNM's proposal is not in the public interest, and it shifts economic and environmental risk from PNM shareholders to ratepayers.
Wow, so it sounds like it's bad all the way around. And a lot of times when you hear about a decision that doesn't make very much sense initially, if you follow the money, you can kind of see that somebody's making money, and that's what the decision's all about. And I'm wondering if that's what's going on here, too. If it's so bad for the rest of us, must be good for shareholders, right?
Seems like a lot of people share your opinion on that.
Yeah. Although, I'll have to say, at the hearing, there were a few people who got up and testified on the very first day, and they said they were PNM shareholders, and they still wanted an increase in renewable energy. And it was really good to hear from those people because, I mean, they're actually making money off of these
stocks. I
agree.
Yeah.
So
that was heartening.
It was heartening to hear that it's not just all about greed.
Yeah.
And we also actually care about, you know, the world we live in.
That's right.
So, I mean, your money doesn't shield you from everything. So what about jobs? We talked a little bit about President Shelley of the Navajo Nation and saying that his people needed those jobs at the coal-fired plants. And what's the deal with the jobs?
Well, and also at the coal mines, yep.
Yeah.
There are also many non-natives desperately unemployed in the Gallup and Grants area who are lobbying for the reopening of the uranium mines so that they can have work. But as many from the Navajo Nation pointed out, what good are jobs if those same jobs make you sick or even dead?
Yeah.
We're perfectly positioned here in the Southwest to lead the country in powering ourselves via solar and wind and biogas, which have dropped dramatically in cost and have the potential for replacing jobs in the coal, natural gas, and nuclear sector. The Union of Concerned Scientists released a document in late 2014 called The Benefits of Renewable Energy, and in it, they document this. Compared with fossil fuel technologies, which are typically mechanized and capital-intensive, the renewable energy industry is more labor-intensive. That means, on average, more jobs are created for each unit of electricity generated from renewable sources than from fossil fuels. Interesting, huh?
Yeah.
Renewable energy, they say, already supports thousands of jobs in the United States. For example, in 2011, the wind industry directly employed 75,000 full-time equivalent employees in a variety of capacities, including manufacturing, project development, construction and turbine installation, operations and maintenance, transportation and logistics, and financial, legal, and consulting services. More than 500 factories in the United States manufacture parts for wind turbines, and the amount of domestically manufactured equipment used in wind turbines has grown dramatically in recent years, from 35% in 2006 to 70% in 2011. This report doesn't even mention the remarkable job creation in Germany, where renewable energy is becoming the major source of power. There's already a template we could follow. And currently in the news, this just in, the United States welcomes India's intention to increase the share of renewable energy in electricity generation, consistent with its intended goal to increase India's solar capacity to 100 gigawatts by 2020. If India can make such a large commitment, why can't we?
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're going to
maybe
take
the,
a short
maybe the
break
president
here.
Can tell them that.
Yes, perhaps
when
he can.
He's there in the next couple of days.
Right. We'll be right back with Earth Matters after this short break. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. I'm Donna Stevens, your host for today's show. Joining me here in the studio is Deborah James, a local climate change activist. So, Deb, I wanted to say that I've been reading a little bit of these this information that you've referenced, and not as much as you have, but many Western states such as Nevada, California, Colorado, they are divesting from coal and increasing their renewable energy portfolios right now. So it seems like PNM's plan will lock New Mexico into 20 more years of coal and nuclear energy at a time when many parts of the country are really moving away from this dirty energy. So it seems like, are we destined to always be at the bottom of the list when it comes to things like innovative and healthy public policy?
Well, my answer to those questions are yes, yes, and yes. And the last yes about being destined to be at the bottom, that hinges on whether or not this proposal is permitted. And I'd like to go into a little detail about that, because you cite Colorado and California as being two states that are successfully divesting from coal. In places like Boulder, Colorado, they have a very affluent community, and they have been able to go through the process of establishing a municipal grid. That means that they have been able to pull away from the state power company. Santa Fe is proposing to do something real similar here because they're in a position of being a more affluent community. But look at most of the communities in New Mexico. I mean, we can't even go afford in most communities to go through the process of the initial survey and, you know, doing the feasibility studies to see if it's possible.
Yeah.
So we're kind of stuck with whatever PNM does in most places in New Mexico. We hope they make the right decision.
Yes, we do hope that. So what are some of the alternatives that the environmental and native communities are really pushing for right now?
Well, I don't have to tell anyone listening about our potential for solar production here in the land of eternal sunshine. In the eastern and southern parts of the state, you don't have to tell anybody about the potential for wind. The biggest argument I hear from the naysayers about wind and solar is the cost of infrastructure that's needed in order to produce electricity renewably and the current inadequacy of the transmission lines. Hmm. Well, now the cost for that infrastructure is so competitive and coming down all the time that the argument really is moot. I don't know if that is true about transmission lines. It's a matter of investment there. Hmm. If you don't believe me, you can Google this stuff. It's truly out there that the costs are coming down. Gil Simmons, whom I mentioned earlier of the New Mexico Solar Energy Association, recently shared some information with me about biogas produced from landfills and animal waste. It's being used to produce electricity quite cheaply in many parts of the country already. And by the way, if you go to the NMSEA.org site, you'll find links to all kinds of useful information like this about costs and job creation and other things that we're speaking about today. Some native communities in California, along with other environmental groups, have complained about wind farms killing birds. I recently read about sound emitters, which are imperceptible to humans, being built into wind turbines, which are having some success in repelling birds. Now, apparently more birds are killed by pets and feral cats than by wind turbines. But nonetheless, the industry is working on this all the time. It isn't that the renewable energy technology is perfect, Donna, but if our policymakers were to offer tax breaks to renewable companies instead of to the fossil fuel industry, which are, of course, the most profitable industries on the planet, all of this research and development could be affordable, and we could move forward with a sustainable lifestyle. One of the things that's rarely spoken out loud in our consumer and fossil fuel-driven economy is that renewables should never be expected to replace the extreme amount of energy that fossil fuels have had generated in the past. Besides not being realistic, it's not sustainable. Breaking away from the commercial pressure we all receive daily to go shopping, to buy bigger cars, to take far-flung vacations, especially with the current decrease in gas prices, to consume. Well, it's just not an easy thing to repel. For generations, we've been programmed to do just that, to support the profits of the fossil fuel and related industries. And it's time that we stop participating and create lifestyles that don't support an unsustainable growth-based economy.
That's right. So it will require some changes in our own personal lifestyles.
That's true. And some people say those are sacrifices. And for those of us who already live simply, which would be probably everybody in this room.
And in this town,
mostly. And in this town, yes. It's the enrichment that comes from living simply. It just far outweighs anything that you might sacrifice.
Yeah, I mean, when I was a kid, my mother was always telling me to turn the lights off, and I left the room. And it's just habit now, you know. But that was because she lived through the Depression.
Yeah.
And they made sacrifices in World War II also. And people were all way into that, you know, the Victory Gardens and rationing and all that kind of stuff. And so it can happen again. Those people were working for a common cause. I don't think they all felt completely deprived.
Yep.
I mean, perhaps somewhat, but, you know.
And when we were asked to, as Americans during World War II, to shift our economy, we did it within a year's time. There's no reason we can't do that again, shifting away from fossil fuels.
That's right. So, Deb, I wanted to say that in the first week of January, we've touched on this a little bit, you and I traveled to Santa Fe, along with another local activist, Tom Manning, to testify on the first day of the PRC hearings. And it was really a long public comment period, and it followed in many of the other days, too, because to my understanding, the hearings went on for 10 days. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of, and there were also many citizens and groups who just couldn't attend because, after all, it's in Santa Fe, so it's a serious time commitment to go up there. And I was really struck by how many of the people from the Navajo Nation spoke about the San Juan coal-fired power plant, the uranium mining, and how it affected the health of their people. And can we talk about that just a little bit more?
Okay. I know. I was really impressed, too. The members of the Navajo Nation and other tribal groups have formed together really all across the whole continent in a group called Idle No More, and they were well represented there. They took leadership of the demonstration that was being held outside of the para building where the hearings took place. And I was inspired by their prayers and their words about the sanctity of the earth and the threats to the earth and on all of her inhabitants. And inside, many of those same nations gave testimony to their unwillingness to participate any longer in the exploitative practices that are taking place in their backyards. They pointed out that this exploitation was handed those who live in the Four Corners area in the name of jobs for the sake of generating electricity, which ironically, many Navajos have never had the interest in, much less the opportunity to use.
Hmm. Yeah. That's
we
amazing.
We heard about the high incidence of lung disease and asthma in the region of the San Juan coal mine and the power plants. The health issues are the result of both extraction and the burning of coal, as well as the mining of uranium for nuclear power, as we mentioned earlier. Though a few of the tribal leaders, as you mentioned, spoke in support of the proposal to keep extracting and burning coal for the purpose of providing jobs for members of their nation, members themselves pointed out this question. What good are jobs when the people and the land are dying as a result of those same jobs?
That's right. I used to have a button years ago that said, there are no jobs on a dead planet. Kind of sums it up. One of the things that my favorite part of the testimony that day was a young Navajo woman who got up and spoke, and she had her son with her.
Oh, yeah.
Who was maybe about three, and he was, you know, really gorgeous little kid. And he got up on the stage and she would say something and then he would jump up and down. It seemed like he was really punctuating what she had to say. And it was this kind of performance. And it was, I thought it was her really drummer.
He was. It was like something
drummer.
Out of the Beatnik era.
Yeah, she would say something really moving and profound and then he would just jump once, you know, and just punctuate it. So speaking of those hearings that we were at, can we talk now a little bit about the role of the Public Regulation Commission, or the PRC? What do they really have to do with PNM's proposed plan?
Okay. Well, since I've been on the march and since I got home from the march, I've really been researching this topic. Hmm. The public regulatory boards exist in every state and have since the 1940s. At the federal level, we have the Federal Energy Regulation Commission, or FERC, as it's called, which we protested against when we were in D.C. And incidentally, this is not a federal agency and is not seated with elected officials. Hmm. State commissioners are elected in most states. It's my understanding that when these PRCs first came into being, they were put in place to protect the health and safety of the public and the environment. In a document I read from the National Bureau of Economic Research, I learned this, however. During the Reagan era, interestingly enough, the regulatory bodies that had built up over the previous 100 years were abrogated, and gas and electric companies began operating in regulatory environments akin to those that had existed in the 1880s and 1890s. In other words, a completely free market.
Hmm.
So since that time, according to the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, or the CELDF.org, if you want to check them out, which is a group of lawyers who has helped numerous communities protect themselves against these regulatory boards that are just riding roughshod over people's health and the environment's health. Anyway, a man named Ben Price, who is a lawyer with that organization, told me that public regulatory boards serve as a buffer between corporate interests and the public in these days. They're simply permitting agencies that have the reputation of permitting what the corporate world wants, as long as all the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted on the application. Public hearings are offered, but the public seems to be catching on that they are being patronized by the process, and the permits will be signed, no matter what the dominant voice is in the hearings.
Hmm. Well, that's very discouraging.
It is.
You know, being at these public meetings where everyone speaks, everyone is opposed to a particular issue, and then it just passes unanimously by the agency anyway.
So we'll hope that doesn't happen in this particular case. We're on a wait and see now.
Okay. That was actually my next question. So these 2 weeks of public hearings have just ended, and I wondered if you've heard anything. I haven't really been following the issue. I wondered if you've heard anything about how the hearings have gone and if the PRC has made a decision on PNM's 20-year plan.
I contacted Alex Rennery from the New Energy Economy in Santa Fe, which is a group of lawyers mostly who are a nonprofit, and they've been informing the public since the PNM plan was first proposed. They have been very active in organizing around this issue, and Alex told me this. I'm going to quote her. Mm-hmm. I speak mainly to the updates regarding public comment throughout these last couple weeks. The hearing examiner has significantly shifted the schedule from the original plan, which was 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. every morning for the 2 weeks, to now only the first half hour of the first day of each week of the hearing. Huh. This means that we had several comments in the morning of January 5th when you and I were there after the demonstration, and then between 3 and 5 on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday of that week, then again at 10 on Friday. When he caught wind that there were 20 faith organizers coming up to fill the allotted hour the following Tuesday, he just changed the rules.
Isn't that convenient?
Yeah. We then had 6 people testify last Monday, and none for the rest of the week, although 5 people did speak during the public comment section at the regular weekly PRC meeting on Wednesday morning. And then this was Friday. She said this morning, 6 people spoke, including one 10-year-old from Acequia Madre Elementary, Regina Wheeler, CEO of Positive Energy Solar, and Joan Brown of Interfaith Power and Light, and about a dozen other faith leaders who stood behind her in solidarity as she spoke. It has been a very powerful and a constantly shifting 2 weeks. So since Alex's report, although I found no articles responding to what the PRC plans to do at this point, I did discover an article speaking about the fact that Farmington has pulled out of its contract with the San Juan Coal Company for its own municipal grid.
Okay, well, let's talk some more about that after a break. We'll be right back. Please stay with us. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. I'm Donna Stevens, your host for today's program, and joining me here in the studio is Deborah James, a local climate change activist. We have been talking about PNM's proposed 20-year plan and the Public Regulation Commission's approval of that. We have not heard what they're going to do yet, but I wanted to ask you, Deb, if we are recording this on January 27th, and I wanted to ask you if listeners can still submit comments to the PRC about PNM's 20-year plan, if they like it or don't like it, and if they can submit comments, how do they do that?
My understanding is that they are still taking written comments throughout this week, so do it right away. But our own elected commissioner is Sandy Jones. And you can call him at 505-827-8020 to register your concerns. That's 505-827-8020. His email address is sandy.jones, and that's capitals at the beginning of each name, at state.nm.us. His mailing address is Commissioner District 5, 1120 Paseo de Peralta. Let's see, I'll say that again. Commissioner District 5, 1120 Paseo de Peralta, or P.O. Box 1269. That's P.O. Box 1269, Santa Fe, New Mexico, 87504.
And I'm sure if people want to, they could just Google Sandy Jones and get all that information if they didn't get all that down right now.
Right. So. I wanted to come back to an article that Alex wrote in response to your last question.
Okay.
Because I think this is kind of important information. It was revealed that there were some gross miscalculations on the part of PNM when they put the proposal out there. She wrote an article called PNM's Billion Dollar Bungle. P- PNM's initial December 2013 proposal to the PRC included 78 megawatts of additional coal from San Juan Coal Plant. A forecasting mistake forced PNM to boost the amount of new coal to 132 megawatts. That's like doubling, increasing the cost of the plan by $222 million. In August 2014, opponents of the plan discovered that PNM had failed to include $532 million in ongoing capital expenditures at Palo Verde Nuclear Plant and San Juan Coal Plant. In November of 2014, opponents exposed $366 million error in PNM's coal cost calculations, which PNM has since referred to as inaccuracy. So together, these errors add up to $1.12 billion in mistakes, all of which PNM has admitted.
Don't those guys have a calculator they can use?
Maybe they didn't have enough spaces for all the numbers.
I guess that must be it.
The result is that PNM's plan is now proven to cost more than either Nuclear Energy Economy's renewable energy-based alternative. That's an alternative that the NEE put out against the PRC's plan, or a scenario that shuts down the San Juan coal plant entirely.
Well, it seems like if you make a mistake that huge, it kind of sounds like it's intentional.
Do you think?
Well, maybe I'm just a cynic. I just wanted to come back really briefly to another thing that people can do if they are concerned about what they're hearing on today's program, and that is to come to the Silver City Food Co-op, which is conveniently located right across the street from Gila Members Community Radio Studio. And local concerned citizen Tom Manning has been tabling out in front of the co-op for a week or so. And he plans to be out there this week, too, to get people to sign petitions or to get some more information. So that's an easy way to plug in also.
And just for clarifying that, we will only I'll be there, too.
Oh, okay.
Giving him a break at lunch.
Yes.
We'll only be there Tuesday and Thursday.
Oh, okay. Tuesday and Thursday. Mm-hmm. So that's today, and Thursday is, what, the 29th?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, Deb, back in April of 2014, of last year, I interviewed you and two other people who walked across the country in the Great March for Climate Action, and you spent months walking across the country to raise awareness about climate change. And I just wanted to ask you, why is this issue so important to you that you took so much time out of your regularly scheduled life to raise awareness of this issue?
Oh, well, maybe I'm crazy, but no.
I don't think so.
It was definitely a life-changing experience. I'm a retired teacher, Donna, and my life has been centered around young people. When I began to write the climate ed sustainability curriculum for Aldo Leopold High School, and that was 11 years ago, that I and other teachers weave into all of the disciplines. At that time, I only knew the rudiments of climate science and climate crisis. But to teach something, you have to be on the cutting edge of the information. So I studied and investigated constantly over those years. The more years that went by, the more I studied, and the more I recognized the seriousness of the climate crisis. But you can't let young people down by telling them that their future is doomed. I had to seek a way to instill hope and to help young people recognize the opportunity at hand to create the future they want to live in. I had to empower them, and I did my best to do so, and I still do. When I retired, I knew I had the opportunity to finally walk my talk.
Literally.
I wanted to hear the stories of those most affected and see the realities of the climate crisis one step at a time, and I did. But I also wanted to surround myself with other people who are as committed as I am, and in some cases more so, to inspiring a sustainable future. You know, 13 of my fellow marchers are on their way to Washington, D.C. right now to speak to a White House spokesperson and tomorrow, and also to meet the director of the EPA to finally get to tell some of the stories that people had to share across the country. That's good. An aside. So now I have this cadre of dynamic activists to add to my pool of wonderful activists right here in Silver City that I get to see or work with, and we get to look from the top of the garbage heap at a movement that's building and that's strong and it's beautiful and it's humane.
So is it true that you're working on this issue as a private citizen and you're not really affiliated with any particular group?
That's basically correct, Donna. I became familiar with the Pachamama Alliance while on the march, and I have chosen to prepare to be a facilitator for their Awakening the Dreamer, Changing the Dream Symposium. A veteran facilitator from the march will be mentoring me as we provide my very first as facilitator symposium in March at the UU Church.
Do you know the date of that?
March 14th.
Okay.
And then we're going to do another one in Truth or Consequences on March 28th.
Oh, that's good.
It appears as though the one in Silver City is pretty much full, but I'll keep you in the loop as to when we'll offer another one.
Okay. So I wanted to ask you, you're such a committed activist, if listeners want to do something about climate change, but they don't necessarily have time to march across the country, what else can they do? Where would you suggest that they start? I mean, is it more important to make changes in our personal lifestyles, or is political action the best course?
Well, as the motto came on the march, it takes everyone to change everything, and we do need to change everything. So it takes those people who are out there doing disruption and direct action, and it takes those of us who can do what I'm doing right now, speaking on a radio program or just talking to your neighbors or changing their lifestyles. We have an opportunity at this juncture to create something new here in New Mexico. When they red tagged those two, the EPA, this is, red tagged the two coal units at San Juan, it was an opportunity. It was a door opening because a new replacement power plant had to be created. How our energy is produced is a huge deal. We have the resources here to begin a new kind of energy production, providing new kinds of jobs. We have the history of being fierce people, too, who know how to stand up for protecting our land and our families. Those of you who've just been working on the diversion plan know all about this. Mm-hmm. If we all participate in democracy in New Mexico, we can become a model energy state, and many other good things will follow. Requiring 50% renewable energy in our electric portfolio by 2020 gets us more than halfway to a very important goal. And it's doable if we all participate in democracy. While I was walking across the country, I was relieved and inspired to discover that there's a movement afoot. Those of us in Silver City who speak up about a changing climate with all its side effects are not random kooks. Millions of people are participating in this movement. Many are volunteering to live simply, and that's not with the hope of cutting carbon emissions so much as being models for a new way of living on the planet. It means minimally consuming, decreasing their travel, growing one's own food or using a CSA, collecting rainwater from their roofs, cutting their utility bills, changing how they transport themselves in their daily lives. Things we can all do, but it takes discipline, and it has to do with understanding your reason for doing it. At the same time, we all need to become activists in our own way by insisting that our democratic system is upheld of the people, by the people, for the people.
That sounds familiar. So, Deb, I know that you've been reading Naomi Klein's latest book, This Changes Everything. We've talked about this a little bit. And I wanted to ask you, what are some of the most important messages you've heard from, that you've learned from Klein's book? We only have about a minute and a half here.
That book is a mixed bag, isn't it, Donna?
Oh, it is.
It's both troubling and affirming. Besides learning many new and often distressing things, she corroborates the conclusions I've been coming to over the last decade. The reason we haven't been able to get a handle on reducing our carbon emissions isn't that you and I are lazy or greedy or any of those other names we've been convinced that we own. It's because we live under a government that really is a corporatocracy. In other words, international corporations, especially the fossil fuel and related industries, have bought and paid for our democracy. You know, it's really hard to understand why there would be the lack of understanding about the fact that we're all drinking from the same well. Their grandchildren and ours.
You know, Deb, I think we could do a whole show on that. So maybe we should think about that. But that's for another day. I wanted to thank you so much, Deb, for joining me here to talk about climate change. And thanks to our audio engineer and KURU guru, Kyle Johnson. And I also want to thank you, our listeners, for tuning into this week's program. If you missed the beginning of the show or any of our other shows, you can go to Gila Members Community Radio's website and look on the Earth Matters page, where you'll find archived podcasts of all the programs. I'm Donna Stevens. Please join us next week for another edition of Earth Matters.